before we go to the one that particularly pertains to events not too many years ahead of us, within a very few years, we believe, we have to go first to the Old Testament to establish certain principles. And we find that, again, out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, a thing is confirmed. And so we find an account in the Old Testament that sheds light on something in the book of Revelation. So we would then first go to the book of Daniel. Now, in Daniel, let us say, the second chapter, we read in verse 31 that the king of Babylon had a dream, and Daniel narrates the dream that the king couldn't remember and tells us about what it looked like. And he states that thou, O king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. And this image's head was of fine gold, his breast, his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, and his feet part of iron and part of clay. And thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, the gold broken to pieces together, and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream that the king had of this great image, composed of different metals. And you'll notice gold, silver, brass, iron, clay. It deteriorates as it goes down from starting with the head of gold. Now, the point we just want to make here is that he states in verse 38, at the end of that verse, thou art this head of gold. You'll notice that it closes the 38th verse. Daniel interprets this dream that the head of gold of this giant image represented the king of Babylon, his empire. And then it says in verse 39, after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee. And we notice that the head was of gold, but the arm and chest was of silver, which is inferior to gold. He's saying that the Medo-Persia Empire, which succeeded the Babylonian Empire, was not as great as the Babylonian Empire. All we're trying to say now is that here you have metal, a head representing an empire, a kingdom, and the arms and chest, another kingdom, inferior. And so we go then to another chapter, just to follow this through. Chapter 5, verse 28. And notice in that 28th verse, where it states, thy kingdom is divided and given to the Medes and Persians. This is the Babylonian kingdom. The last king of the Babylonian kingdom, Belshazzar, Daniel, the aged Daniel now. Daniel's a very, very old man at this time. And he interprets another handwriting on the wall, and he states that after the Babylonian Empire would come this kingdom, which would be divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Now, this is the fifth chapter. The first was the second chapter, where you had a head of gold and so forth. Now he's something completely different, handwriting on the wall, and he's telling what this writing signifies, and he reads it, gives the interpretation in that language, and he says that Perez means division or divided, and he speaks of this same Medo-Persia Empire, which is inferior to the Babylonian Empire we read earlier. Remember in chapter 2, another kingdom shall come after thee which shall be inferior. So this is the next kingdom. In chapter 8, verse 20, we're just establishing certain principles. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings of Media and Persia. This is chapter 8, verse 20. Here we have this Media Persia again. Now we just review. in chapter 2 was the great image, the head of gold, the arms and chest of silver, and that the two arms represent Media and Persia. And he states in that same chapter that the second kingdom would be inferior to the first kingdom. Then we read in chapter 5, where he's talking about handwriting on the wall, that when it comes to a certain portion of that handwriting, he says that word indicates Perez, which means divided. Here's your divided, the two arms. But here it's only a coin or a weight that's being described, Media Persia. Then we come to the 8th chapter, which we have just read last, and it states there that the ram which thou sawest with two horns. Now instead of a human figure with two arms representing Media Persia, here's a ram with two horns representing Media Persia. So what we're trying to say, that sometimes a human form, sometimes an animal form is used to represent not specifically two individuals necessarily. The only reason the head of gold represented the king of Babylon, he was the first king. And it was singular in that it starts with him, and he was the most wonderful of those four earthly universal empires. Although history doesn't seem to know too much secular history on these points. Now, we go back to 7, and we'll note something else. In the 7th chapter, there were four animals. We'll just briefly mention them. In an earlier verse, it tells about a lion.
The fourth.
Fourth verse, all right. And then a bear. Then a leopard. And then it says a dragon. That was so terrible, he couldn't give it a fit name. But it was like, really, it ends up like a dragon in the final analysis. Now, it mentions that this fourth animal that he sees is a fourth kingdom. And now he's describing about this kingdom, for instance, verse 17. These great beasts, which are four kings. Actually, kings in symbology very often means kingdoms rather than individuals. Are four kings which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom, possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. Then he asks in verse 19, Daniel, I would know the truth of this fourth beast, which was diverse from all the others, exceeding dreadful, whose teeth were of iron, nails of brass, which devoured, break in peace, stamped the residue of his feet, and of the 10 horns that were in his head, and of another which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes and a mouth that spake great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows. And I beheld, and the same horn made war with the saints, prevailed against them, until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given to the saints of the Most High, and the time came that the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be the fourth kingdom upon the earth, which shall be diverse from all kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, and shall tread it down, and break it in pieces. And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another rise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and subdue 3 kings. And then it mentions that this little horn that grew up in verse 25 would prevail against the saints of the Most High before judgment would come upon it. All right. The reason we've led up to this, animals representing kingdoms, and here this fourth kingdom really looks like a dragon in the final analysis with 10 horns. And we find this prop up in the book of Revelation. So we get some idea now, a little bit of an idea, that it represents some kind of a kingdom. And it doesn't just last a few years. It can be even centuries, which we find in the book of Revelation was the case. And that this would prevail against the Lord's people, which has happened down through the Gospel Age. This is the persecution of the Lord's people during the Dark Ages when they were put to death. Now we're going to come to the scene that's all this is a preface just to establish that animals represent kingdoms just like the American Eagle represents the United States. The bulldog represents Great Britain. The bear, the Russian bear, represents Russia. So we use language like that today, but some people forget that the Bible uses the type of language we have. All right, now we come to what we really want to zero in on, and that would be chapter 3 of Daniel. What we'll have to do is have a reading of this. Sister Esther, if you'd read verses 1 to 7, and then Sister Gail, 8 to 18, and then we'll go around. I'll mention the verses as they become significant. And this is going to be just a reading now, but then we'll review this reading.
Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold, whose height was 60 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, sent to gather together the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, and the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces, to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. Then the princes, the governors, and the captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then an herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, the flute, the harp, the sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." Therefore, at that time when all the people heard the music of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up.
All right. Now we have a beginning of a drama that actually took place in history, but which the Bible later draws upon that incident and tells us, in effect, that it is a prophecy, a prediction of a circumstance that would arise in the future. And the way we know that is this has already happened back in Daniel. The king of Babylon, who was a real king, did this, did make this image in the plain. And he did have all the provinces. Notice that it gives people a little higher up, like officers and princes and rulers and sheriffs. In other words, he didn't bring all the people, and he took the representation, a complete representation of the empire, of all his province, and he brought them to the scene of where this statue was, that they would do obeisance to it, bow down to it, to show their harmony with not only the king, his authority, but his religion, the god. He set up an image of gold. We find out that this was a religious symbol. So it tells us the measurements. Notice what they were.
60 by 6 cubits.
60 by... Now that's interesting. It tells us the height of this. So it's 90 feet high, which is quite high. I mean, your tallest tree would be anywhere around here is not even 90 feet. So the statue of gold, don't forget, made an image of gold. It says image. It means statue. It's a three-dimensional image, not a flat image. So this very impressive statue was erected in a plain, on a level, so that everybody could see it, conveniently, because it would tower over all the people. And notice it says they stood before it. They were all gathered before it. So all this representation of people were in the background, like a throng. And the statue is here, facing them. And then the key was, once the music sounds, when the king gives a signal through his representative, all right, start the music, like the Star Spangled Banner. Mm-hmm. They play the Star Spangled Banner. You're supposed to, like, stand up and put your hand on your heart or raise your right hand, depending when you live, 10, 20, or 30, 40 years ago. It's been changing slightly down through the years. Well, when the music would start and the band played with all these diverse instruments, the people were to get down and prostrate like the Arabs do, see, and bow down like this. And that would signify their harmony coming from a long distance to come for this occasion, for the dedication, it says, of this image. And by that act, they would be showing their humility and subservience to the king. Now, this is just what he says, and then he says there's a penalty. If you don't do that, he had a furnace, a fire, like a pit with a cauldron of fire. And anybody who would not worship that, and so you'd see this pit burning, and you'd see the statue, and putting two and two together, it means your life if you don't bow down. So we can see now what the circumstance was. They could see the penalty, and it was a very simple act. All they had to do was just could bow down. So simple. But with a person of conscience before God, that's another matter. It's not that simple to do that. That'd be compromising. Yes?
I thought it'd kind of see who, at least at this time, if I was there, it would kind of tell you who you fear more, man or God.
Yeah. So it was a very strong test. Now, in verse 8, we'll read verse 8 through 18, Sister Gail.
Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fury, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Then they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, do not ye serve my gods, nor worship the golden image which I have set up? Now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up.
All right. Now you'll notice this reading, this latter reading, was from verse 8. So what has happened, this was done. The music was struck up, and the people did bow down. Now, the king may not have noticed that there were three individuals who did not bow down. Sometimes you look at television like this Khomeini and you see several hundred thousand people. Well, if three people didn't bow down with all these people gathered in that tremendous plaza, you wouldn't know it. So what they did, when the music played, these three Hebrew children did not bow down. They remained standing. And these other people tattle on them. It says, certain Chaldeans, verse 8. They came near and accused the Jews. In other words, they told the king several things. They told the king there were three that didn't bow down, and they're Jews. They had it in for them because they were Jews. And that was like a dig to the king. And don't forget, it was this king who was instrumental in their elevation, because Daniel did it, but the king was instrumental in the elevation of some of these Jews to very high positions in his government. And then the next thing they said, they did not bow down. But instead of saying, they did not bow down to the God you set up, it says, These people never worship your gods. They said plural. There was only one god there, one statue. But it said, these three, they tell the king, these three, they don't serve your gods. In other words, what they did today, they've been doing that all along. They've been doing this all along, not cooperating. So they put it in the plural. Now the king gets mad as can be. Why does he get mad? Well, not only because they crossed his will, but he was embarrassed that on this occasion, where you had such unanimity of agreement, that these three had the nerve to stand up, to remain standing, and he was the one who honored them, and they couldn't do the decency. I'm thinking from his standpoint, see, his reasoning. He's thinking, why couldn't you cooperate and do that? And so he gets incensed, furious. But now he's ready, and he's going to say, I'll give you another opportunity. Now, when I give the signal, and they start the music all over again, the second time. Now, when they start it the next time, I'd like to see you, do that. They interrupt him. They don't have to wait until the music. They're going to tell him right away. Now, as regards what you're going to say, hold on a minute, as it were. In this matter, we're not going to be too careful to answer thee. We've been very respectful in the past. We didn't want to hurt your feelings. We tried to be polite. But now this occasion, we cannot do that because this would be involving our conscience. This is different. And now in this case, in this circumstance, we're not going to do it. And we wanted you to know, not only that we won't do it, but our God is so powerful that if he so chose, even though you were to throw us in that furnace, we would not die. He would deliver us. So that's how strong our... But we'll tell you anyway, if he doesn't care to deliver us, our God, say he doesn't, nevertheless, let it be known to thee, we're not going to worship your gods. Not only on this occasion, but any future occasion, because they put it in plural. Not just the singular, that one God. Now the king, you can see, he is now, if he was mad before, now he's ready to burst his spleen. I mean, he's so mad. And this is all done before his high officials. This isn't a private thing. So he's being insulted, as it were. I'm thinking from the king's standpoint. He feels he's insulted, embarrassed before all these people. And now he says, You heat that furnace up even seven times hotter than it is. If it's hot now, you just heat it as much as you can. So these three then not only did not kowtow and bow down, but they were very courageous in boldly stating. They didn't pussyfoot around this issue. They just said bluntly, we're not going to do it. So they laid the cards on the table. This now is a setting. This is what happened. And now we read verse 19 through 25. Next, please.
Then was Nebuchadnezzar full of fury, and the form of his visage was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Therefore he spake and commanded that they should heat the furnace 1/7 times more than it was wont to be heated. And commanded that the most mighty men that were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their hosen, and their hats, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning furnace. Therefore, because the king's commandments was urgent, and the furnace was extremely hot, the flame, the fire slew those men that took of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down, bound into the midst of burning fury furnace. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king, was astonished and rose up in haste and spake and said unto his counselors, did not we cast these three men bound in the midst of the fire? They answered and said unto the king, truly, O king. He answered and said, lo, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they were not hurt. The form of the fourth is like the Son of God.
All right. Now, he gave this commandment that the furnace should be heated. If it was red hot before, white hot now. And he sought that three mighty men of the empire. This would be one muscular. And to dramatize this, these men are all dressed up now. These three Hebrew children, it says they have their hats and the hosen and garments on. These are the garments of office that they had, because they didn't come in their work clothes on this occasion. This was a very religious occasion. And so what happened, to make it a public example, here they bind them tight. Bind them tight. Well, once they're bound like that in their own clothes, they're like wooden sticks. I mean, they can't have much flexibility. And so then these mighty men could cart them like a log of wood to be thrown into the furnace. And so as they approach the furnace, the flames are now coming out furiously, and they inhale this, the men, and they're consumed, because in a fire it's known that if the flame comes, a big flame comes, and you breathe it in, your lungs just evaporate, as it were, in an instant. But they must have fallen into, as they came near the perimeter of the furnace, fallen in into it headlong, and of course the ones they're carrying also tumbled in, because that was the purpose. They carried them to the furnace, and the three men ended up in the furnace. They had been bound up, but the other does not say necessarily the other three went in, but they were consumed in this transport. Now, that seemed like, for a moment, you can imagine the king on the throne before this big cauldron or lime pit with naphtha and so forth, bitumen involved, that he probably saw some activity in the flame as he's on the throne. That there's something in. So he evidently leaves his throne, and he goes down, and he looks in to see if he was just dreaming what he thought he saw. And instead of, yes, sure enough, he did see something, and here it was. Instead of three, it was four in there. And then he turns to the counselors and said, didn't we cast three in? And, oh, yes, O king. Oh, yes, O king. Yeah. And he said, but I see four. And one of them, he is like an angel of God, like the Son of God, as it were, in there. This would be very awesome. And now he's got to think what he did. The men perished. I carried them in. And here they're walking. They're walking. Not running, because it's hot. They're not running up to get away from the heat. They're walking in there, evidently even conversing, possibly, with this one who had delivered. In other words, they were impervious to the flame. So then we read 26. So we have to read 26 now through the end of the chapter. This will be the setting of the lesson tonight, but not the end of it, we hope.
Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spake and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, ye servants of the Most High God, come forth and come hither. Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came forth of the midst of the fire. And the princes, governors, and captains, and the king's counselors, being gathered together, saw these men upon whose bodies the fire had no power, nor was an hair of their heads singed, neither were their coats changed, nor the smell of fire had passed on them. Then Nebuchadnezzar spake and said, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who hath sent his angel, and delivered his servants that trusted in him, and have changed the king's words, and yielded their bodies, that they might not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore I make a decree that every people, nation, and language which speak anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made a dunghill, because there is no other god that can deliver after this sort. Then the king promised Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon.
Yeah, he promoted them.
Promoted them.
Yeah. So now his attitude changes entirely when he sees them walking there. And notice he pleads. And he says, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, please come out. Come out. Now in the meantime, the people who had been standing before this statue, and presumably the furnace nearby, they were witnessing this whole thing. And they couldn't smell the garments and things like that there, only those near to these men. But they could see that they come out of the furnace, walking out of the furnace, and they don't seem to be troubled, and the king is talking with them, then they know something very unusual indeed has happened. And the king now is just the opposite. When he was furious before, now he makes like an oath that anybody speaks against these people in the future, oh, their house is going to be a dunghill, as it were.
Against their God.
Yeah, against their God. Then he promotes them with more honor in that picture. Now, of course, this is what happened in history. This is like historical event of the past. In the book of Revelation, when it picks up this account, it's going to show how the antitype or fulfillment of the future on a larger scale will take place. But notice here that when they come out of the fire, it wasn't merely that they were not discomforted. It's that even the hair on their head was not singed. Well, you just take a match or a candle near your hair, the hair is shriveled right up without even being in the flame, just the heat of the flame nearby. And not only that, their garments, instead of being all messy and bedraggled, they seem to be dressed just as nice now as before they went in, and not even the smell of smoke on them. So it mentioned this was a most remarkable miracle that took place in the past. Then the king, he was not that unreasonable that he couldn't stay.
But the cords were...
Now, that's it. But the cords which bound them was consumed. In other words, the fire which ordinarily consumes did not consume anything except the cords, was very selective. So it was the God of nature, the creator, controlled this destructive fire to be very selective, to only burn the cords. Now we have a hymn that aptly describes what these cords represent that were consumed in this fire.
Fetters of flesh.
The cords were the fetters of flesh that are consumed. In the antitype, we're going to find out, but we haven't too much time on this, that in the fulfillment of the future, the Lord's people who will be living at that time, who will have and experience something like this, not with literal fire, but with another circumstance which we'll consider a little bit, they will, in the furnace, instead of them walking out and being unscathed and unhurt, they will be transformed to another life. They will indeed be put to death, like Jesus was put to death. Jesus died, and he seemed to be defeated. But that was merely incidental to his later awakening, resurrection, and elevation, ascension in high. So instead of it, what appeared to be death, what happened, his earthly career terminated, but he was rewarded from that. He was promoted from a human being who died to a glorious spirit being next to the Heavenly Father, and given even more glory than he had before he came down here. So now this picture, though, is coming down to this end of the age that we're now living. And this is what we want to consider. Revelation. Now, just before we go, we just want to read the first verse of Revelation, the last book of the Bible. Sister Chai, if you read that.
The revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave unto him to shew unto his servants things which must shortly come to pass, and he sent and signified it by his angel unto his servant John.
All right. Now, all we'd like to call attention in this verse is simply that the book of Revelation, the last book of the Bible, was to show God's servants, who are related to Jesus, things future. When it says things which must shortly come to pass, it means, based on what later occurs, begin to come to pass. Because these visions here in Revelation tell us the history of this gospel age, which you'll find not written out in the book in cohesive form. Here it is, but all under symbol. Now you'll notice that he sent and signified it, instead of signify. This message is a message of symbols. Now let us go to the fifth chapter. Let's read the first verse.
And I saw in the right hand of him that sat on the throne a book written within and on the backside sealed with seven seals.
Read a little more then.
And I saw a strong angel proclaiming with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the book and to loose the seals thereof? And no man in heaven nor in earth, neither under the earth, was able to open the book, neither to look thereunto.
Keep going through verse 5.
And I wept much, because no man was found worthy to open and to read the book, neither to look thereon. And one of the elders said unto me, Weep not, behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, hath prevailed to open the book and to loose the seven seals thereof.
All right. And then it shows in the next verse that Jesus is that one who was found worthy. But now we see here the Heavenly Father, and he's seated on the throne, and he has a scroll in his right hand, and he's holding it. It has writing on it, on the outside. And evidently that book, maybe there was even a spotlight on it in the vision. You know, as though he sees in the throne one sitting. And it's God in symbol, a figurative representation of God as a human figure. Maybe John was back of him on an angle, and he sees in his hand this scroll. And his attention is called to this, and it has a lot of secret information. Then an angel is standing in the vicinity, and he's shouting out, Who is worthy to open this book? Well, not only was there a light on it, but there's an announcement, because it says this angel with a loud voice, so he must have had a tremendous voice, and no one was found. So there's a big pause. Who's worthy to... And here's the scroll, and no one's found. And now John, as this silence prevails, he begins to weep. And he weeps because no one is found worthy to open that scroll and to interpret it, what it has in there. But then it says one of the elders steps up to John and pats him, let's say, on the shoulder and says, Don't worry, somebody's been found. The Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, he's been found. And this to assuage John's sorrow. And then what happens, true to what the elder said, there appears a lamb, as it were, freshly slain, which goes up to the throne and secures this scroll, takes it out of the right hand. Now, the lamb, it wouldn't be a lamb in the normal sense. Maybe it was like to take that scroll out of the hand of the Father, it must have been that he had draped over him, as it were, a lamb configuration all over his body. But that it actually, he's the Lion of the tribe of Judah, and yet he's a lamb, but he's actually a being, a spirit being. He's freshly slain. He takes the scroll, and then he's going to break the seals. And so subsequent chapters show that as he breaks this seal, something happens. He breaks a seal and he opens it up. A lot of startling things happen. And that tells us about history. The first part of history, the Gospel Age. When he breaks the second seal, it's the second stage of history. The third. And he comes down to the seventh. When he comes down to the seventh seal and breaks it, it's in our day. At the end of this age. So then it becomes important, as we come to this, we come to chapter 13 now. We might as well read it. Let's just read this pretty fast. Sister Esther, if you'd read 6 verses, and Sister Gail through 14, and Brother Barry the balance.
And I stood upon the sand of the sea, and saw a beast rise out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his horns 10 crowns, and upon his head the name of blasphemy. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, and his seat, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast. And they worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, Who was like unto the beast? Who was able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God, to blaspheme his name, and his tabernacle, and them that dwell in heaven.
And it was given unto him to make war with the saints, and to overcome them. and power was given him over all kindreds and tongues and nations. And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him, whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world. If any man have an ear, let him hear. He that leadeth into captivity shall go into captivity. He that killeth with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and the faith of the saints. And I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns, like a lamb, and he spake as a dragon. And he exerciseth all the power of the first beast before him, and causeth the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. And he doeth great wonders, so that he maketh fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast, which had the wound by a sword and did live.
15-18.
And he had power to give life unto the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak, and the cause that as many as would not worship the image of the beast should be killed, because all, both small and rich, and poor and free, and bond to receive a mark in their right hand or in their foreheads, that no man might buy or sell save he that had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him have understanding, count the number of the beast, for it is the number of the man, and his number is 666.
All right. Now, just to review briefly. John is standing on a seashore, and he's looking out on the ocean. And out of the ocean comes this strange-looking beast, and it describes this beast as having the seven heads and ten horns. But he also observes a dragon in this picture as we go along. So now there are two symbols, the dragon and a beast, and they're both very powerful. It tells that the whole world is involved with respect for these two beasts, two kingdoms. Then when it speaks about how it says, but strange, the beast is really more powerful than the dragon. But they're both, no one can stand before them. They're so powerful. But the beast is the most powerful. Then comes along another beast. But this time, the beast comes out of the earth. Instead of out of the ocean, a beast comes out of the earth, and this beast has two horns, not ten horns, like the other one. And it says that this beast also does miracles for a while. But then, strange, it talks about an image of the beast, a statue of the beast. Now, the difference here is, we see the setting is that the whole world is involved, instead of just the princes and the sheriffs and the various ones back there that we saw in Daniel. Now, it's a worldwide picture. This involves many kingdoms of the present age. And it tells then that there's this statue erected, and this two-horned beast tells what will happen. If you don't bow down to this beast, such and such is going to happen. But this two-horned beast, he somehow gives power, whether he touches that statue or not. The statue becomes alive. It says, it begins to speak, this statue. And this statue that speaks is the last scene in this chapter. So what it does, it's a review of what's happened, the terrible persecutions and things that have happened during this gospel age, of which the present generation knows scarcely anything about. Millions of people have been brutally murdered, burned, tortured at the stake, and that the present schools, the colleges are just, some of the intellectuals know about it, oh yes, but they usually are people who want to know about history. The government is not specially helping you along in that way, but it's for those that have a hunger, a desire to know about history. They can find it, but they have to go to the library or take special courses. All right, now, you'll notice in this picture that 666. Notice it says, here is the man that has wisdom. Note this. Count the number of this man, what this statue represents. And that he that helps us understand as to what this statue represents has to do with the number 666. Back there on the plain of Dura, it was a statue 60 cubits high and 6 cubits broad. But you can see a multiple of 6. And it's tying it in. And all had to worship there when they were given a signal. And here it says that no man could buy or sell save he had the mark. There had to be some indication of approval of this image. It looked like an Ash Wednesday. If you have a smudge on your forehead on Ash Wednesday of the year, that tells you you're Catholic, doesn't it? I mean, Ash Wednesday, very often that's how you know people who you may not have known what they were for all year round, but when comes Ash Wednesday, you have a mark on their forehead. It's like saying, I'm a devout Catholic. I may not go to church much, but I'm a Catholic, nevertheless. Well, here we have something similar to that, that there's some that, spiritually speaking, there would be some indication of approval of this setup, of this worship. And the hand would mean, we say, a helping hand, giving somebody help. You mean support. You're giving support. So to have the mark in your hand means you're giving support. To have the mark in your forehead means you not only give support, but you mentally agree. You are in mental agreement. So this is telling us a story here, and now we haven't time to pursue this because we took a long time with Daniel 3, which was necessary to help see a little bit of this other chapter, which maybe sometime in the future we might take a little time to go into it a tiny bit more. But this is a religious arrangement, church and state. And what is happening today, when we look out over the world, we see that this desire of religious churches to unite, the Catholics to unite, the Protestants to unite, and they're all hoping that somehow or other, even Catholics and Protestants might unite, and thus establish one church of Christ, and they think all this is in harmony with Scripture, where actually it's the opposite, because they compromise doctrine and principle in coming together.
Yeah. Yes. When I was with Eric, we went and met with Father John, who's father of the St. Anne place, one Tuesday. He told us all about Catholicism or whatever. And then he told us that right now all the leaders of the church, like Protestant, Luther, the breakoffs, they're meeting in Rome. Mm-hmm. And like you say, they're trying to work together so they'll be one. And they're dropping some of their beliefs.
So this is what's happening. Whether the public realizes it or not, this is going on. Most people are interested in maybe, let's say, sports or disco dancing or some other things. I'm speaking in general. They're not observing too much what's happening on the sidelines and spend a great deal of their time in these other fields. The number 666 in Latin points out the title of the papacy. Vicarius Filii Dei was a prominent symbol used. The triple crown that the Pope wore in the Middle Ages had this emblazoned on it. Also, over the doorway of the Vatican, there was this banner that indicated this. And so if you take Vicarius Filii Dei, the vicar of the Son of God, that's what the Pope claims to be. He claims to be, as it were, Christ on earth. But seeing they think Christ and God are the same thing, it's like God is Christ on earth, and the Pope is his representative. Not only is he his representative, but he has equal authority. And in some cases, he even has changed Jesus' words. That's even assuming even greater power in certain acts that he's done down through the past ages. And so we find that this... Did you want to say?
Yes, Brother Frank, you brought out in the SQ study the measurement, the reed. A reed is a 6 cubit. That's a statue of Jesus Christ. And the 666 is the imitation of that.
Yes.
Perfect number.
In the tabernacle and so forth of God, the multiple of 6 is very prominent. But that's the true 6. That's the sacred 6. That's shown in the tabernacle, in the book of Revelation too. But this 666 is the false Christ. But it's not just papacy here. It's the image of the beast that's involved. And this is like a united Protestantism. The Protestants and the Catholics are going to come to a working agreement, and those who do not cooperate are going to be marked as being not with us, as it were, from their standpoint, and it will mean martyrdom at the end of the age. And what is it? What's this mysterious six? We think it will have to do with the Trinity. You notice it's three sixes. And so they will brand all religions that do not agree with the doctrine of the Trinity as being cults. Whatever the group is, if they do not believe in the Trinity, they will be branded as a cult and will suffer the consequences thereof. So those who happen to be living at this particular time, the scriptures are informing them not to give in or to yield on this. And if they are faithful in their belief and are steadfast, they will be rewarded for whatever harm comes to them, as it were, and given compensatory, more than compensatory, will be honored for that faithfulness that these three Hebrew children in ancient times manifested by their not yielding to that circumstance. And it's the simplicity of what they had to do back there, with the simplicity with what will be required in the future, that'll be very beguiling, will be very deceptive. Because all you have to do is, you don't have to mentally agree, just give a little support, like a donation or something like that. So it isn't necessarily that they just want to see that there's some cooperation. And those who don't, they're marked. And they're not going to be able to buy or sell, it tells here. So pressure will be brought to bear. Notice in the 16th verse. And that this trial will be so severe that it doesn't matter how much money you have. Doesn't matter how wealthy you are or influential. When this happens in the future, it's going to cut across all strata. The poor, the meek, the humble, the proud, whatever they are, who don't give in to this arrangement, they're going to suffer for it.
But how great the reward, yes, if we can stand fast.
And so when it says, here's when let him, that it's the number of the beast. And the beast is a religious government in the book of Revelation. And we haven't time to go into all these details, but we felt that it was absolutely necessary first to consider Daniel 3, because that's sort of the foundation. So we have to close here. We went a few minutes over. We started about 10 after. An hour and 5 minutes.
Father Frank, just that scripture in Ephesians 6:11-13 seems to be a fitting conclusion.
All right. Read it.
It's really an instruction to us right now. Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. And combining the thought in verse 13, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all to stand, the evil day being this persecution period in the near future.
Yes, it's called the hour of trial, the hour of the beast. It has several titles.
And when that time comes, you'll have to know how to rightly divide the word of truth. So it's study to show thyself approved unto God, the workman that needeth not to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth.
So we conclude this study now. Would that be all right?